Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting me. It's nice to be back, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk on this work, which was with Enrico and also the stringy model with Liam, Enrico, Alexander, and Gang. And we had two marathon sessions yesterday and today, one on axon monodromy, the stringy construction itself, and then we had one today about the CMB, and I'm going to be talking about the interplay between axon monodromy inflation and the CMB. So since it's mostly a stringy audience, I'll introduce the quantities that I'll be looking at in the CMB. Now, even though we had a long talk about the CMB, I think my approach is slightly different. I mean, Phil was mostly worried about foregrounds and how you measure something. I'll assume they can do that and just present what you can do if you can actually do a nice measurement. And then I'll tell you a little bit about why we talk about the CMB and strings in one sentence in the first place. Because it's a highly non-trivial statement, I think, because the CMB is emitted when the universe has a temperature of about a quarter of an electron volt. And yet we somehow claim we learn something about the gut scale from it, so that seems non-trivial. I mean, you might think that you learn more about strings from the LHC, but I don't think it's true, and I'll explain why that is. And once I'm done with these two points, which we'll see how long it takes, but after that I'll tell you about the signatures of axon monodromy inflation, and I'll conclude. Okay, so, well, and I should say the introduction to CMB observables. For everyone who's looked at this before, there won't be anything deep. And feel free to get a coffee or read the latest detection, the 3 sigma detection of FNL local. So.
Are you going to tell us about that?
No. Okay, so here we go. So just for now, think of the detectors as a device that counts the number of photons, as we heard earlier, and that you can also measure the polarization of the photon, and you measure it, well, per unit time, per unit area. So what you measure is really an intensity, and it's a function of the direction you point the detector at in the sky. It's a function of the polarization, so you can just think of it if you want as there being some polarization filter on your detector, and it depends on the orientation of that filter, how big the signal is. And then it also depends on where you do the experiments, which I denote by X. To a good approximation, you can ignore that. So this is at L2, and I'll set, I mean, you set that to zero. You have to go about 100,000 light years away from the point where we do it now to get another look at the CMB. Everything you do within the solar system or close by, you just see the same CMB over again. It also, in principle, depends on time. But again, this is a constant that doesn't really enter. Again, you have to wait about 100,000 years and make another measurement to get a clean new look at the CMB sky. In principle, you can beat down cosmic variance like that, but I don't think we'll be around for that. So, okay, and here, well, Phil talked a lot about the frequency dependence of the signal, and I show you two detectors. So these are two of the detectors on the Planck HFI instrument. This one is the 100 gigahertz, which is where we expect most of the cosmological data to come from. This is the 857 gigahertz detector, which is where we saw the dust. Okay, so the intensity, you're right, is some large constant piece, which is what Penzias and Wilson measured. And then there's anisotropies in the intensity, otherwise we wouldn't be talking about. There's one piece that's independent of polarization, so it just depends on where you look in the sky, but it's independent of, if you want, the orientation of your pole filter. And then there's a second piece that depends both on the direction and on the polarization, and this is what a lot of people are excited about. This has been measured by WMAP. It'll be measured, well, first by COBE, then WMAP. It'll be measured much better by Planck, already has been, but they don't show it to us. And then this one also has, part of it has been measured. Okay, and these one can easily show, or it's usually they're shown as sky maps, so you just, since delta T is a function on the two sphere, you just show it. Blue means it's colder, red means it's hotter, so the red strip here is just the galaxy, and you don't really want to look at it if you're a cosmologist, but you can't do anything about it. Yeah, okay. And then the Stokes parameters you can also show in the same kind of way in sky maps. These are the quantities you really measure from your detector. That's really what the readout is proportional to. But they're not really the quantities you can predict from theory or make a useful comparison between theory and experiment, simply because they depend on where we are in the universe. They depend on initial conditions. So what you have to do, I mean, for a given set of initial conditions, you can generate a sky map, but we don't know what the initial conditions are. The only thing that we can predict are the probability distributions of the initial conditions. So what we do look at, theoretically, are ensemble averages or stochastic properties of these things. So if you want, you calculate for a given set of initial conditions, you calculate delta t in this direction, delta t in that direction, multiply them together, and then average over all possible initial conditions. This is one thing you can look at. Then you can look at correlations between temperature and the Stokes parameters with each other. And if the CMB is Gaussian, then these are all there is. The higher endpoint functions, the odd ones vanish. The even ones are sums of products of these guys. And if it's non-Gaussian, which is what a lot of us are interested in, then you also need to look at the higher endpoint functions. Okay, now these are still not the most convenient ways of looking at the data. So what you look at, Phil already introduced these, you look at expansion coefficients. So delta t is a function on the two spheres, so you expand it in terms of the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian, the YLMs, and you get these expansion coefficients. Similarly, these guys are components of a two tensor on the two spheres, so you expand those in terms of the eigensections of the Laplacian for these guys. They're the spin two spherical harmonics, the details really don't matter, but you get another set of coefficients. You don't use these directly, you use a linear combination of them because they have nice properties under parity. Okay, and now what we can do is we can look at the correlations of these ALMs and rotational invariance. So if you want, Schur's lemma tells us that it has to look like this. So it can't depend on M, it has to be diagonal in M space, it has to be diagonal in L space, but it can depend on L. And so you get one TT spectrum that everyone's seen, then you get TE, EE, and BB, and BB is what everyone's kind of hoping to see. But anyway, so if it's Gaussian, then all the information about the CMB is contained in these four power spectra. So these are really used mostly to make the comparison between theory and experiment. And mostly, very schematically, you can also get these from experiments. So you take the measured sky map, get some measured ALMs, and get the CLs out. I mean, it doesn't quite work that way. That's for an ideal experiment. But the details aren't important. It's just, I want to stress that these are really the quantities that you use to compare theory and experiment, if you want. Okay, similarly, you can look at the three-point functions for these guys, where x runs over t, e, and b. Now, the only one we're really going to be talking about is t, 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 because even that hasn't been measured. And we're also not really going to be talking about this b, l, l, l too much, because the only thing right now we've been constraining are, for a given shape, you constrain the amplitude for that shape. So you boil everything down into one single number. And similarly, you can do higher endpoint functions, but those have also not been measured. Okay, so this was really all I wanted to say about the basic CMB observables. That's pretty much all I'll be using about them. So unless you have questions about those, I'll tell you why we think that by measuring these guys, we can learn anything about the gut scale. I won't say strings, because I'm not so convinced, depending on how you wake up. I mean...
Question. Yeah. In your previous transparency, you had two issues with the three-point function. One was data, but the other was just analysis techniques.
Well, it just gets computationally intensive if you want to measure these things. But there's no in-principle obstruction. I mean, you can do it. It's just probably also it hasn't been done because the data isn't good enough. So I think it's...
But this has to do with diagonalizing something in the matrix or something.
So you want to measure each one of these beams and then do this independent.
What is the problem with analysis tools that needs to be solved for you?
For one little b, or well, one specific generic b, or well, one entire thing, you have much, very, very much going to be there and still in the CB now. So then you have to combine many different ones. Yeah, for this, yeah, it's very efficient because you have all the AL and all the M, so you combine them. Yeah, it's not enough. So you just combine many, many L's, and you have enough signal to know.
Okay, so let me try and say how we go from the EV to the gut scale, and most of the discussion will be at the level of just linearized GR. So you linearize around a flat FRW background, and mostly this is to introduce notation. So all the details won't really matter. I mean, this will be schematical. But so you get some scalar modes in the metric, you get a tensor mode, just the graviton, then there's other scalar modes, the energy density, the perturbations to the energy density in baryons and cold dark matter, whatever you have around. But the system we're going to be interested in really is the system that describes the evolution of the universe for temperatures below some 10 to the 9 Kelvin, where electrons and positrons have annihilated, and this is all there's around. And then the scalar modes, I should say, can generate TT, TE, and EE, but not BB. The tensor modes can generate all four. And the fact that the scalars don't generate it and the tensors generate it makes it exciting to look for BB, because it would be a direct measurement of gravitational waves. And I'll ignore the vectors for now. They would also, in principle, generate BB, but okay. So just to give you an idea, I mean, there's a system of equations. The details, again, really don't matter. That looks like this. I mean, some equations of motion for the metric, some for the cold dark matter, for the baryons. There's a Boltzmann hierarchy for the photons, a Boltzmann hierarchy for the neutrinos. You solve these equations, and then once you have a solution, you can calculate the CLs from it. Again, the details aren't so important, but I would like to stress that it factors into two pieces, if you want. So it factors into a piece that is this, I mean, that's computed from the late time evolution. This comes from the solution of the system of equations that I didn't really show you. This, again, mostly depends on what the geometry is. If you don't do it in a flat FRW background, you get something different from the spherical Bessel functions. But this part for my talk, it's interesting, but I won't be talking about it because we want to go to inflation. And the only thing inflation can possibly tell us is what this guy is. Usually people make a direct connection between this and inflation, but it's slightly tricky because really the only thing it does is it gives you the initial conditions for the system of equations that I've showed you so far, and it's not completely obvious how you go and extrapolate that all the way back to inflation, but let me tell you why that works. And so the only thing you need to know about the system of equations to understand this is that there's two scales involved. There's for a given mode, there's the momentum of the mode, and there's the expansion rate of the universe, and the solutions drastically change depending on whether the momentum dominates for the mode or whether the Hubble constant or the expansion rate of the universe dominates. And to see when that happens for a given mode, people usually draw diagrams like this. Now, everyone draws it in a different way, and anyway, here what I'm showing you is the physical momentum, which is K over A. This is some co-moving wave number. This is the FRW scale factor that appeared in the metric. So I'm showing you this, and it's a log-log plot, so K over AA just has slope minus 1. Then the Hubble constant always goes like 1 over T when it's matter-dominated or radiation-dominated. And during radiation domination, A goes like the square root of T, so H goes like 1 over A squared. During matter domination, it goes like A to the 3 halves. What's important is that the slope of H is bigger than the slope for K over A, so you see that they intersect somewhere. And so for this picture, we say it's inside the horizon. The reason we say it's inside the horizon is because the physical wavelength is small compared to the horizon at that time. And these are the modes we observe, and so now as you go back in time, you see that they started out outside the horizon. So you want to look at this period, and this is where you set the initial condition. So we want to understand the system of equations when the modes are outside the horizon. This has been looked at by people a long time ago, and what one finds is that the system of equations has 5 solutions that don't decay. There's 4 isocurvature solutions, and there's 1 adiabatic solution. Experimentally, we find that only the adiabatic solution seems to be excited, and that's important. So, and the importance of this is that this solution has the property that there are quantities R and zeta that are conserved outside the horizon, so where we're interested in this system right now. And one should also say these quantities are sufficient to specify all the initial conditions for this system.
And when you say the system has four isocurvature solutions, what are you assuming? I mean, you're assuming there are only baryons and photons?
So the system I was looking at is the Boltzmann hierarchy for the photons, the Boltzmann hierarchy for the neutrinos. It's the baryons, then there's dark matter, one component of dark matter. And did I forget something? yeah, dark energy, I suppose I forgot, but yeah. So these are the equations, and in that case, you have five. If you put in extra stuff, you get more. Okay, so R and zeta are conserved outside the horizon, so it's easy to, if you want, extrapolate backwards. You say, as long as the mode is outside the horizon, nothing happens. But this is clearly only true as long as this system of, from what I've told you so far, this is clearly only true as long as the system of equations I've been studying is actually valid. And the system of equations is only valid below 10 to the 9 Kelvin. So we're still far away, which is about a tenth of an MeV. So we're still far away from the gut scale. So how do we get there? And the answer is that you can show in general that for a general matter content, there always exists a solution with constant R, pretty much whatever the matter content is. The reason I cite Steve Weinberg is not so much because he was the first to show it, but because I think it's the most complete proof. And okay, so we can extrapolate it very far back, no matter what happened. So when it's outside the horizon, it doesn't care about all the stuff that went on while it's outside the horizon that we don't know about, like the electric phase transition, dark matter decoupling. But eventually, we want the guy to start out inside the horizon because we don't want to have a causal initial conditions. We want to somehow generate the initial conditions causally, and that means that these two lines I've been drawing at some point have to intersect again, and the mode has to start out inside the horizon. For this to happen, you do need a phase that satisfies this. So d by dt of k over ah is less than zero. Now, if you drop the k and just it's a constant, so it's 1 over h, the derivative has to be less than zero. This is what some people like to use as a definition for inflation, even though it really isn't, because you can also have it in a contracting phase. But you can either have a phase of inflation or a contracting phase, and then you set the initial conditions.
Actually, just a comment about the first statement.
Yeah?
This is only true if you have no entropy perturbations.
No. I'm only saying there exists a solution. I'm not saying, I mean, there can be other perturbation. There is a solution where it approaches this. I'm not saying it's always an attractor. I'm going to talk about that now. Yes, there exists a solution. It's not clear that it's an attractor yet. Okay, so the picture now looks something like this. So the modes started out inside the horizon. Those are the modes we measure. They were outside the horizon for a long time, and up here they're inside the horizon. So if you run it the other way around, they start out inside the horizon. The idea is here you generate the perturbations as quantum fluctuations during inflation. The mode exits the horizon, and then that's important now what you said. So the only way you can make a prediction about the CMB is if in fact you approach the solution with constant R. And there's two cases in which we know that this is an attractor. And this is if there's single field inflation, the isocurvature modes aren't there. And also if you have a phase of equilibrium without conserved charges, there's the isocurvature modes decay. In those two cases, you can make a clean connection between inflation and the CMB. In other words, in single field inflation, the anisotropies in the CMB directly tell us about the inflationary dynamics, which is nice. Now, in multi-field inflation, you can, in principle, still make predictions as long as you can follow the dynamics until you approach the constant solution. So you want to, then you have to, the burden then is higher. I mean, it becomes more model dependent in a sense, because you have to know about reheating. But if you understand reheating and you can follow it until you're on the constant solution, you can still make predictions for the CMB. If not, then you can't make any predictions. Yeah. Okay. Now, how do you calculate these? I mean, to be more concrete, in single field inflation, the quantity R at the linear level in spatially flat gauge, to be specific, looks like this. in, or if you like, Leonardo's coordinates, then it looks like this, where these are the, is the pi that we talked about yesterday. And the initial conditions are then set by this, by the by these two-point functions, where these are now vacuum expectation values. And there's some factors of, so translational invariance tells you there's going to be a delta function. Rotational invariance tells you it can only be a function of the magnitude. And then there's some conventional factors of 2 pi, and you factor out a 1 over k cubed. And this is the guy we'll be looking at later. So that's, for instance, one of the things I'll be calculating or showing you the results for axiom monodromy inflation. Then the next quantity you can look at is the three-point function. And again, you factor out some factors of 2 pi, some k's, and then there's a shape left over. Again, this comes from translational invariance. Okay, and for single field slow roll inflation, you can immediately write down what the spectrum looks like. It looks something like this. And NS equals 1 is a scale invariant spectrum, so it just doesn't depend on K. This guy is just a constant. And single field of inflation predicts that NS is slightly less than 1. And this was what Phil was talking about. I mean, measuring this NS, Planck will be very good at. Okay, and yeah, and S, if you want, in terms of the slow roll parameters, takes this form. The next prediction of standard single field slow roll inflation is that the three-point function is too small to be observed. And then what you can do is you can take this power spectrum and combine it with the physics that we understand, the physics of recombination, and you compare it to the data, and you find these plots, and it fits nicely. I mean, this is the WMAP 7-year results for the data, where the error bars are tiny, so these are just instrument noise, and then the gray band indicates cosmic variance. And so this is TT, which I introduced. This has been seen for a long time. Now, TE is also measured to very high significance, and I mean, it just fits the data. Now, in addition to the scalar modes, what may be even more exciting is that inflation also predicts a nearly scale invariant spectrum of tensor modes. And what's exciting about them is that they only really depend on the Hubble constant during inflation. So this is if you measure these, you get a direct measurement of the energy scale of inflation. Now, you can ask, how do you know? I mean, the same discussion I gave you for the constancy of R, there's the same argument you can do for the tensor mode. So this is, I mean, the same arguments run. Okay, yeah, so this gives you a direct measurement of the scale of inflation. Whether you see them or not is often discussed in terms of the tensor to scalar ratio, which has also appeared a lot already. The tensor to scalar ratio is just what you would think it is. I mean, you take the tensor amplitude divided by the scalar amplitude. And the reason it's interesting is because you can directly relate it for single field models, standard single field slow roll models, you can directly relate it to the energy scale of inflation. So we can see inflation when it happened around the gut scale. If it happens much below the gut scale, we pretty much don't see anything. The second reason why it's interesting is because it tells you how far the field must have moved during inflation. And it moved over a distance. Okay, and so you see that if it's bigger than 0.01, the inflaton must have moved over a distance large compared to M Planck. And this, if you look at it in effective field theories, I mean, this rings all kinds of alarms. And so, well, in particular, but
is 0.01 comes from?
This is just plugging in.
Planck scale to Gut scale, or what?
This is just plugging in numbers. I mean, if you want, I can go through the derivation on the board. I mean, the delta phi, it's just plugging in numbers. So I'm assuming, what I'm assuming here is something like you need at least 30 e-folds of slow roll inflation is what I'm assuming to get this specific number.
Look at the formula. The 1.06 times to the 16 GB is what?
Communal normalization.
Yeah, so it's a mix.
Because the sort of figure of merit for, as he's going to say in the next slide, for Planckian experience.
You're saying why don't I write R over 0.1 and put a different scale? You're welcome to.
There are two things, the bottom formula and the way where the incrementalists say they can get to.
The point is the current data is already ruling out R of around 0.1, so it's normalized to R of around 0.01.
Wouldn't you have said that the last line, it's just, that's the Planckian boundary. It's the boundary of a Planckian experiment at this point on the
line. Yeah, but I think if the...
Okay, well, so by itself, this doesn't mean that an effective field theory description breaks down as long as the energy densities stay small, but you still have to worry about corrections to the potential. And this is why you want to look at it in a theory where you can compute these corrections typically, which right now I think the only theory where you can compute these corrections is string theory. Now, from an effective field theory point of view, you can just say if you want, well, you can ensure that these are absent because the field enjoys a shift symmetry. Then you can say, well, this makes axions very natural candidates as long as you can break their shift symmetries in a controlled way. But then really you should show that this does exist in a quantum theory of gravity or, say, string theory, rather than just making big assumptions at the level of effective field theories. Okay, well, and if you assume that the inflaton is an axion that has its shift symmetry broken by the potential, then it also seems natural to look at the instanton effects, and you come to the conclusion that you might want to look at a potential that looks like this, where this is some potential that supports slow roll inflation, and then you have some contributions. And the phenomenology of this is basically what I'll be talking about in the last part of my talk. So before I get there, let me briefly show you that the current bounds on the tensor to scalar ratio from WMAP plus Baryon acoustic oscillations plus a measurement of the Hubble constant is that it's less than 0.24 at the 95% confidence level. So the inflaton has lots of space still. And we don't really know much about how far it moved. In future experiments, we already heard this in the last talk, the tensor to scalar ratio may be constrained down to about 0.001, but it's not clear how important it is to spend the $1 billion to get from here to here. So, okay, we don't know. But in this plot, what I'm showing you is the signal for the E modes. These are scalar contributions, so these are there for sure. And then they contribute from gravitational lensing, what I'm showing here, they contribute a contribution to the B mode signal. So out here, you're going to have to worry. But mostly we're going to be interested, I mean, for this and other reasons, mostly we're going to be interested in the B modes for less than L of 100, say. And then here also is another problem that makes these experiments hard, which is what we heard a lot about in the previous talk, is there's foregrounds from dust, synchrotron emission. And here are the contours for WMAP, 0.03. And this is some guesstimate for what Planck can do, 0.01. So probably you won't see anything unless it's something like 0.05. Okay. And I think this is all I wanted to say about the basic CMB things. So now I will tell you about the signatures of axion monodromy inflation. I hope I've introduced all the relevant quantities. But if not, you should interrupt me and ask again.
Why does it have to be a cosine potential?
No, it doesn't have to be. Yeah, you can. Are you worried about higher? We can look at that later. So you can still. There's a formula where I leave it in principle for a general potential if you want, but we look at the cosine potential just because that's what we can control, I think, mostly. You're worried about somehow with not only the leading cosine contributing, but all the higher instantons, so no. Yeah, I mean, you can have it. We just can't calculate it, I think, is the upshot. But yeah, I mean, that gives you different shapes if you want. It gives you different signatures. I'm not saying this is the most generic model. I mean, I hope it's not coming across like that. I don't mean to say this is the most generic model. This is one model of large field inflation that one is sort of close to realizing in string theory. And so this is why I'm looking at this, not for any fundamental reasons. Okay, so the only thing you need to remember from Enrico's talk is that in this axiom monodrom inflation model, you get a potential that looks something like this. So you get, for large field values, you get a potential that grows linearly, and then you have modulations on top of your potential. And what you want to do now is just look at the observables. The first two observables I'm going to tell you about is the scalar spectral index and the tensor to scalar ratio. I'll do it in the absence of instanton corrections for now, but it doesn't really change the conclusions, as we'll see when I look at B not equals zero. But so the reason one shows it in this kind of a plot is because they're degenerate. So you see that it's tilted, so you want to look at the combination of the two. And then these are the model, the predictions of some of the most simplest inflationary models. This is lambda phi to the fourth, which is ruled out. Then there's m squared phi squared. There's inflation. And this is the Harrison-Sildovich exactly scale invariant spectrum. And at this point, it looks like it's ruled out by about, well, I won't say ruled out, but it's disfavored at 3 sigma. And here's the prediction for axiom monodromy inflation, so for a linear potential. And you see it fits nicely, has a lot of space inside the contour. And the nice thing, I should say, what's nice about this is that Planck will, in fact, tell us if this is OK or not. So it'll either rule it in or out. So there's no wiggle room. I mean, either it still sits inside the contour once Planck is done, or it doesn't. So we'll get a definite answer whenever they decide to release their.
Yeah. I'm sure you can adjust your model and then match it then.
Not really. There's really essentially no wiggle room. So you see there's some wiggle room because we don't know. So this is the number of e-folds before the end of inflation at the pivot scale exits. So you have some wiggle room, but not very much. So this, and in principle, this is calculable once you specify how reheating works and how everything works. But we don't know how reheating works in this model even less. But so there's some wiggle room just from our ignorance about reheating. But otherwise, I don't think there's something you can adjust for a linear potential. Yeah, this.
So you couldn't just consider phi to p with p less than 2? And
phi to the p you can consider if you want. But it's a different model, though, right?
There's a trend in your plot, which is phi to the 4 by
yeah.
Phi. You might think you should plot phi to the p.
You can. Yeah, I mean, you can, for instance. I mean, also, the phi to the 2/3, I mean, also sits nicely in here. I mean, you know, yeah, there is that trend. So it's 1 sigma, 2 sigma, so 68 and something like 95.5. Well, it's constrained to be small. So what you really should be doing if you want to know what the constraint on the tensor to scalar ratio is you should marginalize over this parameter. In other words, you should project whatever the likelihood function you have for these two parameters onto this axis. And then you'll find something that, I mean, it's constrained out here. And it's going to look something like this. I mean, so that's where once you marginalize, you get these constraints. It looks surely the central value of your distribution, what you get once you marginalize over it, is certainly compatible with zero, but it's also, I mean that's the bound I showed you before. I mean, there's a bound. So this is, in fact, the bound I quoted before. This is WMAP plus Baryon acoustic oscillations plus H0. So once you do what I just said, you marginalize over it, then you get that R has to be less than 0.24 at the 95% confidence level. No. Yeah, so all you can get out of this is a bound, so you don't know anything more. Okay, and the second observable is the primordial power spectrum beyond just NS. And this is what you get if you turn on the wiggles and the potential. The modification is not captured by the standard slow roll approximation for the power spectrum. And this is because there's a parametric resonance in the model. And I'll tell you where it comes from. It's not hard to see. And yeah, so you have to solve the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation. I'm not sure what I mean by carefully. I mean, you have to solve it. Okay, so this is what the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation looks like. This is the evolution for R. Outside, so the variable X is what I previously called K over AH. So deep inside the horizon, X is very large. So this term drops, and you just get a harmonic oscillator with frequency 1. Once you exit the horizon, this becomes small. So you see that this term becomes very important. This term can be dropped. And then you see that a constant R becomes a solution, just because you only have R prime involved. So constant R becomes a solution. Okay, this, you have this equation together with these slow roll parameters. There's two things. First, ignore these terms. Epsilon star and delta star are just what they were before. So the NS is what it was before. And then we look at these corrections. But I'll drop these in the discussion. They just give you the NS. I already told you what it was. So let's look at these. And you see that they're, well, this is a cosine, this is a sine. So they're going to be oscillating functions. And you know that if you have a harmonic oscillator, I mean, just from standard classical mechanics, you know that if you have a harmonic oscillator for which you either vary the frequency periodically or you vary the friction terms periodically, you'll get parametric resonance if the frequency with which you wiggle it or jiggle it, or it becomes twice the natural frequency of the system. And this is also what happens here. You see that it scans all possible frequencies because you have this log of x. So you get a parametric amplification if the frequency here, which is just, I mean, you take the derivative, so it's just the square root of 2 epsilon over f times x, when that becomes equal to 2.
So that's this solution of the Mukhanov-Sasaki equation is valid for any slow-roll background potential. So that's why you write everything in terms of slow-roll background.
Yeah, so this is more general than just the linear potential. This works for any slow-roll potential. Yeah, thanks. And so now let me ignore the constant pieces in epsilon because they're not so crucial for what I'm telling you. I mean, the resonance. And just look at this. So this is the term that's going to be oscillating. Now, you know that long before the resonance, if you drop this, the solutions are just Hankel functions, some linear combination of Hankel functions. You know that the positive frequency mode is this guy. So C minus initially is just 0. You also know that at late times, this term doesn't matter. So again, the solution is a linear combination of Hankel functions. So in principle, it should be a linear combination of this guy and this guy. But one can show that at linear order in B, this is still 1. And this becomes non-zero, and it approaches a constant at late times, just because then this effect is gone. So you write down an equation if you want to solve it for this guy. And at large x, the equation looks like this. The details of the equation aren't important, but you can solve it, and the solution for Cx looks like this. So at large x, large k over ah, it's what I said. It is essentially, it starts out at 0 and then begins oscillating. And then you enter the resonance and exit it. And then this is the modification you get for the power spectrum. The orange line is a numerical calculation. The dashed line is the analytical result we get in the paper. I mean, they agree. Okay, once one has a solution for R, it's easy to get the power spectrum. One just squares the thing at late times. And one finds that it looks like this. So it's the standard slow roll power spectrum times 1 plus this cosine term with delta and S given by this quantity. This.
What have any approximations been made so far?
Small b and slow roll for the background field.
Can you remind me what V is?
So I wrote the potential.
V is the coefficient of the mu cubed cosine.
Yeah. But and the reason I introduce it in this funny way, so more naturally you would write the potential in maybe something like this, plus lambda to the fourth times the cosine. The reason we write it in this slightly funny looking way, e times mu cubed f, so this is just lambda to the fourth over mu cubed f if you want. And the reason we write it this way is because this is really a good expansion parameter.
Is
in the solution.
This would naturally show up, or do you need a coincidence of scales?
That what would naturally show up?
So as you said, there's a term, there's a b cubed, a mu cubed phi, and then there's this other thing controlled by a new parameter lambda.
Yeah.
And for that to make it observable.
Ah, so for the, okay, good.
But not to actually stop inflation, presumably lambda and mu have to have some special relationship.
For the linear potential, b is just a constant, so the wiggles always have the same size. For other, the same influence. For other potentials, yeah, it changes. I think that's mostly an accident for the linear potential that it doesn't matter.
I think he's asking
about
the amplitude of the cosine piece.
For you to see it?
Do you need a coincidence of scales for this effect to be visible but not stop inflation? If the coefficient is too small, it's invisible. If the coefficient is too large, you don't inflate.
Yes, definitely. Okay. I'm going to show you the bounds on this coefficiant. Yeah, I mean, just
it is a pretty large window. Sensitive to it within like 3 or 4 orders of magnitude.
You mean when it's very small?
Yes.
Because it shows up over many years.
Yeah.
Assuming that it is smaller than 1, then it might be sensitive to it on 4 orders of magnitude.
Okay.
So
it doesn't
have to be.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah. Okay.
1 is already excluded by the data, and that 10 minus 4 might be excluded depending on that.
Yeah, it depends a lot on F, but I'll show the plots so for the how big it is.
So this effect is happening on super hot scales.
It's when the mode is deep inside the horizon. So sub-Hubble.
That's why you said the effect went away at late time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it goes away even before the mode freezes out. It happens deep inside the horizon, really, at early times. Well, you can make it happen anywhere, but if you want to get a signal, you have to have the effect before you freeze out the mode, essentially.
So, your assumption about B times F or something?
About B times F. So, B is treated as an expansion parameter in the whole thing. And we're also assuming that this quantity, in the formula I'm writing, I'm also assuming that F over the square root of 2 epsilon, which is for the linear potential, it's F times phi star. I'm also assuming that that's a small number in Planck units. So in writing this formula, but we have a general formula. It just looks missing. This is small, yes. It's much less in. Not in this formula. I can show you the other formula. It just looks slightly messy with hyperbolic cotangents and whatnot. Yeah.
We would be very happy
if we could,
but we still haven't done that. So
that
necessarily has to be small.
Yes.
F is small,
but...
Yeah.
Okay, but sorry, but forget...
But for it's...
I think you can look for the condition that forget about gravity, just to see what happens. Forget about the year, one second, and just...
The modulation is such a long wavelength modulation that it doesn't affect anything because you just lift the whole spectrum over time. So in that limit, you wouldn't even put a constraint.
It doesn't go to zero, it becomes degenerate with the amplitude if you want. With AS or delta R squared. Is what happens.
The amplitude is
going to... Well, this formula you just shouldn't look at in that limit. No, this you shouldn't look at for large F. But we have, if you want to look at it, we have it.
Yeah.
Okay, so I would just show you the bounds on it, but they look a lot like Mathematica plots, mostly because they are. But the thing is, we did a more serious analysis. So it's not just some code you would run in Mathematica in half an hour. We compute. I mean, it involves calculating 33 million CMB spectra, and we do it on a grid of 33 million points. So for each point, we run CAMB and calculate the CLs, and then we used a modified version of the WMAP likelihood code, which then became the official WMAP likelihood code for a little while. And okay, we do this for 33 million spectra for these grid points. I don't think you care too much about it, but there's more than just a mathematical plot anyway. So here's the bound on delta NS as a function of F. F is again the decay constant in Planck units. And you see that WMAP, this is 5-year data, that WMAP constrains it to be, say, less than about 0.04. It constrains it at the percent level.
Just to be sure I understand what you're plotting, you've assumed the background U cubed phi inflationary model.
Yeah.
Now you're parameterizing deviations from that and assuming that's the correct point to expand about. You're saying what deviations are allowed by WMAP?
I'm looking at the power spectrum I just showed you and feed that into the calculation of CAMP and calculate the CLs. I'm also going to show you the CLs for the best fit point in a second.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason I'm showing two plots is mostly just because this one is easy to remember. For F above about 10 to the minus 2, you know that delta in S is the guy that's constrained to be below, say, 4%. And this plot is easy to remember. For F less than 10 to the minus 2, you know that B times F, so this expansion parameter times F, again in Planck units, is less than about 10 to the minus 4. So those are the constraints you get on the model parameters from WMAP. They're equivalent if you want, but I'm showing different things on the vertical axis.
The vertical.
Yeah. I mean, you can go from this to this by just using the formula I showed you on the previous plot. Okay, so yeah, I should.
Yes,
there's a. Yeah.
But just because you asked about the quiz, one way to interpret the fact that we are plotting BF is that is BF what is constrained by the data? So even if you change B by two orders of magnitude, then apparently change F, you're still sensitive.
But what I'm showing is that it depends on what value of F you're looking at, what's constrained, right?
Yes, yeah. But from 10 to the minus 4 is constrained.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's B times F if you want that string.
So you don't need B to be right inside the number, but it can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, back again. So this was the best fit power spectrum. It sits somewhere in this spike. It has a delta chi-squared of 11, but I wouldn't really take it seriously. It's mostly fitting the noise, in my opinion. So
why were there spikes, by the way, in the plot?
So this is because, you'll see it in the next plot, I think it becomes clear, because the data is very noisy. So you're starting to fit the noise in the data, depending on what frequency you have. So yeah, this is the best fit model, and you might ask, well, I showed you the plot before where this smooth CL spectrum fit the data so nicely. How can this fit the data at all? And the answer is really that the plot I showed you before, the data was binned. So you combine a lot of bins and then the error bars get small. If you plot the raw data, it looks like this. So you have a lot of room for wiggles in this data. And WMAP 7 presumably is better, but I haven't run it for that. Okay. Yeah, so that was all I wanted to say about the power spectrum. Now I'm just going to tell you about the non-Gaussianities in this model. It was already observed by Chen, Easter, and Lim that non-Gaussianities with large delta dot, which is what you generate in this, where delta dot was this low roll parameter, which I kind of didn't. I had it on a slide, but I didn't say much about. Should I say again what it was? So the way I defined delta dot, well, delta is the second derivative of the Hubble constant divided by 2h, h dot. So it's the fractional rate of change of h dot compared to h, if you want. So
it's epsilon and eta. What is it?
In terms of epsilon and eta, we have something like eta minus epsilon over 2 or something.
Yeah,
it's essentially, well, yeah, for what we're saying, it's essentially eta. And it's eta over 2 minus epsilon. Okay. And so, yeah. So we want to calculate the three-point function. It takes a tree level. It looks like this, where the dominant piece in the interaction Hamiltonian is given by this for us. And the reason it's dominant is just because you have delta dots. If you make that delta dot large, this term becomes important. The commutator is straightforward to evaluate, and after some algebra, you find that the shape that I defined before, so this is the three-point function modulo the delta function and some factors of 2 pi and stuff. The shape looks like this. The reason I'm giving the formula like this, which looks slightly messy, is twofold. So one, just for my own purpose. Delta dot is again some sinusoidal function with a log of x, so the frequency changes in it. And you're integrating it against some other oscillating function. You know that when you integrate two oscillating functions against each other, you get a large contribution when the phase is stationary. And in the stationary phase, we can evaluate this. So it's the fact that you multiply these two oscillating functions against each other that makes it easy to evaluate.
And is that also what makes it easy to generate a large contribution?
Yeah. I mean, well, it's the largeness of this term, if you want, that directly comes in.
It's the largeness of that as opposed to the transition of the oscillation.
But I thought your question was more general somehow. I mean, are you just asking this compared to slow roll, or this compared to something else?
Compared to other models where you generate non-Gaussian entity, I just wanted to understand if you were saying that part of the intuition here is that you get to cancel the oscillations in the interaction Hamiltonian against oscillations in the mode function.
In this case, yes.
Yeah. And that helps it pass the signal.
Yeah. And well, the second reason I'm showing this, and that to some extent goes back to Jonathan's question, you can plug in any. I haven't really made an assumption about what delta is at this point. So into this formula, you can plug in any delta, and for any delta. So this also goes back to the discussion yesterday on whether there's a finite number of shapes of non-Gaussianities in single field inflation. And here clearly you see for any crazy model you come up with that has some funny looking delta dot, you get a different shape. How well motivated they are, I mean, probably not at all, but it's a logical possibility. I mean, you can get whatever shape you want from these kind of things.
A lot of these would have spikes in NS, though, that would be observable.
Yes, yeah, you always have to worry about whether you... Yes, but in our case, for instance, it's, in a sense, in NS, or in delta NS, you observe it when F... So when F becomes too small, the signal in... scales differently for the 2 and 3 point functions. So it's not completely obvious that in the same regime where this is large, the signal for the 2 point function is large. It's certainly something you have to check. Okay, for us, I mean, you just plug in what delta dot is you computed for the model. You get a shape that looks like this. And, well, K is the sum of the three momenta, and FRS goes like this. So you see it goes like 1 over F to the 3 halves, or if you write it in terms of lambda to the 4, it goes like 1 over F to the 5 halves. So as you decrease F, the signal grows very rapidly. One thing I... Sorry.
So at some point it washes out if the windows are so rapid that...
That's... in this guy, not really, but it's not detectable in the CMB anymore. Yeah. Yeah, and one thing I wanted to point out just for people who know what it is. I mean, we check that it satisfies the consistency condition. In other words, there's a relation that relates the shape for squeezed triangles to the two-point function, and we check that this shape, in fact, satisfies that consistency condition. Okay, so let me just show you what the shape is instead of looking at the function. And what I'm showing here are the squeezed triangles, so it's, and for different values. So this is f of 10 to the minus 2. Here are the squeezed triangles, here are the flattened triangles, here are the equilateral triangles, and you get this kind of a shape. And
is this oscillating in K space?
Yes. You'll see more oscillations. You're wondering
where they are in the plot?
Yeah, yeah. So this is because f is kind of largish in this plot. So if I make f smaller, you get more.
So this also, just to belabor this illustrates that you could have a large squeezed contribution without a second.
No, this is not large. It does satisfy It does satisfy the consistency condition. So it's still small. The FNL local is always small in this still. Yeah, it's because the local shape only comes from the second term, which is subleading in this expansion in Fi star. So the local condition is not enhanced in the same way the rest of the spectrum is enhanced.
So, okay.
I checked that delta S was going to 0 for f goes to 0, right? And you said that
yes.
The radius for f.
Yeah, but the, it comes
f,
from.
F, the radius for f goes to 0.
Yes.
The delta S
goes to 0, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, but it's still not very large. I mean, if you want to know what the I draw it in a realistic scale, so the FNL is whatever is on this axis, if you want. So it's an FNL of order 1. So it's not something you would see. This is tiny.
The plot diverges there.
Yes, it diverges. Yeah, it gets large, but if you convert it. Yeah.
Just for reference again, just numerically, how big was delta NS allowed to be in this model?
How large? Well, so B times F. Yeah, B times F has to be something like less than 10 to the minus 4 for the range we're looking at now. I'm only looking at F smaller than 10 to the minus 2. For larger F, you don't see anything.
Okay.
And then this relation holds. Well, this is in Planck units.
You had a delta NS
before.
0.04. Okay. That's tiny.
No, delta NS can be larger for these. I mean, delta NS is not constrained. This is F of 10 to the minus 2. Well, there it's still about 0.04, but for the ones I'm going to be showing, delta NS can be larger.
I mean, if she's worried about this plot.
This plot is about 0.02 or something, yeah.
Oh, okay, so
that is.
No, you have to be slightly careful because what you're doing is, it's because we wrote it in this funky way. It's because there's an F in here. So really, you shouldn't think about it that way. If you write it in terms of lambda to the fourth instead of in terms of this guy, then it doesn't go to zero like the square root, but it diverges like the square root. It just changes because of this factor of f.
So it depends.
I mean, we had.
Okay, so it goes one on the left to the three half.
So the delta in S. The delta in S. Okay. The delta NS went to zero. If you write it in terms of B, it goes to zero, like the square root of F. But if you write it in terms of lambda to the fourth, it diverges like 1 over square root of F, just because we have this F in here. So you make the effect.
So in the limit F goes to zero physically, in the limit F goes to zero, which means that I'm giving the frequency a lot, the relation to the tilde is also becoming very large.
Yeah,
like that.
That freaks out, and so yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So normalizing cover, let's say, because the normalizing cover, there is also delta net.
It depends on lambda, right?
You can write the full, that is B times square root of F, and if you can write it in terms of
lambda,
it's lambda divided square root of F. So you have to
talk
about what you call the cube fix. If you look at cube fix, the number is over the delta,
then it diverges. If you want to keep B, which has not the fundamental physical meaning there, but it doesn't.
Well, over the screen.
I think the screens are different, it's a frequency of oscillation is different, right? I mean, I was wondering what happens in the limit of the frequency of oscillation was confused.
But you also have to specify, I mean, there's two parameters in this model. One you can call lambda and f. I mean, one you call lambda, one you call f. You have to specify both. So what are you going to do when you take f to zero? What are you going to do to lambda, say? In this, we're saying, I mean, it looks funny in the formula we wrote because naively it looks like it goes to zero, but that's because you're holding b fixed. It goes to zero if you hold this quantity fixed. And that's because if you hold this fixed, I mean, that means you're just making this small.
Isn't it obvious if you take the frequency to be extremely high, all that happens is you get a constant shift to the potential, which is the average energy of the cosine, which is like 5 times lambda to the fourth. That must be what happens.
Yeah, so physically,
yeah. You're high frequency mode, you get a constant shift.
Yeah, because this means that the limit of high frequency is really taking that b mu cube, because the speed of the inflection is really mu, is the potential. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, then it really, yeah, it goes. But then the surprise, it doesn't cancel that as well in the frequent part, which is a, yeah.
But you're saying that limit, you should just be shifting B, but it's not canceling the frequent part?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand that, yeah, and it seems so, yeah.
Why are we shifting anything?
I'm not doing anything.
If we keep the amplitude lambda fixed, right, then we get these very steep rapid oscillations. So delta NS is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a question of washing out of the data, but before we talk about that, you get a big signal.
Yeah, before the washing out of the data, before the washing out in this dimension.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you get a big signal to that.
Yeah.
So our analysis was done when the potential is monotonic, so we are going down. So if you crank up the frequency, the potential at center point is not monotonic anymore.
Well. But that depends again on what you keep fixed. I mean, B is exactly what measures the monotonicity.
If B fixed, then the potential is fixed as more than one. The potential is always monotonic. And
yeah.
This is also a pretty long, detailed discussion of one particular model, which may not be of interest to the entire audience.
Yeah.
So
yeah, okay. So, well, I just have a couple of plots for different values of F. So now you start seeing the oscillations better. And you're also starting to see, well, not so much in this plot yet, but in later plots, that this signal becomes larger and larger compared to this little spike in the squeezed configuration. And then, well, this is the last one I'm showing for f is 10 to the minus 3. And then just so you don't get the impression that these are fixed shapes, I'm also showing you one where the K1 is running, so I made a little movie out of it, and let's see what happens. Should start playing eventually, I hope.
What is time evolution?
Apparently the Hamiltonian is zero.
Yeah. Well, time evolution, if it were to actually run, which it doesn't seem to want to do, then it would change K1. So K1 would be increasing in the movie.
What's
K1? So I'm plotting this. The shape as a function of K1 and then these relative, these ratios. And it seems to be completely frozen. But yeah, I'm not sure what this is. Here we go. Well, the movie didn't work. The movie? Here we go. Okay, so here you see the movie, and this is when K1 changes. I mean, when you increase K1, so it's really changing. It's not a fixed shape, if you want. I mean, yeah, it is if you plot in a different way. But
what determines the number of waves?
This is F.
That's just F, I see.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so now that the movie worked.
And so what is the kind of largest amplitude of that now effect?
FRS?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so you can make it fairly large. I mean, it goes like 1 over f to the 5/2, so you can make it large. Now you can ask if it's So the question then is mostly, can you still observe it in the CMB? Because if it gets too fast, it's really going to wash out.
Right.
And I think the largest is about, you can get an FRS of about 10 to the 4 or something like that. So this is a bit preliminary because we've never actually calculated what it looks like in what we haven't calculated the BLLL. So I can't exactly tell you what washes out, but just naively I expect that it's okay up to 10 to the 4. I mean, you have to really do these integrals. There's a lot of, if you calculate the BLLL, I haven't shown the formula, but they involve a lot of other oscillating things. They involve a lot of other spherical bestions, and you just have to do these integrals with this primordial shape, and then I'm not completely sure if it washes out in this or not. I mean,
but in particular, if you take reasonable parameters where it's not ruled out by the two-point function,
yes,
and it's ruled out by a very naive thought about detection of the three-point function,
yes,
not all those things,
yeah,
way above the many hundreds that you might think would be the expressed answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Except we don't, I mean, you have to be careful because we also don't really know what the constraint is on this shape, which is basically what I'm saying now. So the question is, can we convert existing constraints on local, equilateral, orthogonal shapes, which we have, thanks in part to Leonardo, can we convert this into a constraint on this shape? And the answer is not really, because if you calculate these correlations, which I won't really define properly, but essentially they're some normalized inner products on the space of these shapes. And if they're one, then there's a large correlation and you can convert the bounds if you want. If they're small, you can't really convert them. And for the range of decay constants we look at, the correlation is always small. It's always at the percent level. So you can't really easily convert them, and there's no real constraint on this shape right now. So we don't know what's observable either. You can in principle, yeah. Well, we've been thinking about it with Richard, but we haven't gotten very far. So it's doable, but, well, so one issue is that it's easier to do if your shape is factorizable, what people call factorizable. This shape isn't factorizable, so you have to think of some smart way of doing the analysis. So, yeah, so the answer basic, yeah?
Yeah, so my question, which was technical, but I agree with it's kind of surprising, which is the signal is very big, the correct goes to zero.
Mm-hmm.
But in the two-point, just in the two-point function,
No, you do get it in the two-point function. I'm not sure I'm agreeing with that. What are we keeping fixed? So if I keep lambda fixed?
Okay, then, yeah. No, but then the constraints in the two-point function, you expect to be almost down. That's surprising.
I mean, it's because it's just because it scales differently with f. I mean, one scales like 1 over the square root of f, the other one scales like 1 over f to the 5 halves. So one grows much faster than the other one. If you keep lambda fixed, in the other case, it's...
This goes for all higher endpoint functions. I mean,
yes.
The higher point the function, the more f there are in the denominator.
Yeah.
You keep appropriate things fixed.
Yeah.
Hold on. Then, I think that the endpoint function is...
Well, we haven't calculated that, but that's what you expect anyway. Yeah, and that was pretty much all I had to say. I don't have much of a conclusion. I mean, the model, I think, has interesting signatures, and they're a large tensor to scalar ratio, which it's 0.07, which I'm not sure, I don't think I have had it on any of the slides. But Planck will tell us whether or not this is realized. And, yeah. And it also, yeah, it has this potentially a modulated temperature and anisotropy spectrum, even though that doesn't have to be there. Lambda can be small, and potentially it produces resonant non-Gaussianities. And this kind of resonant non-Gaussianities, independent of the model, deserves further study because currently we don't really know much about constraints on it. And yeah, I think that's all I had. So thank you.